There we go. Sorry, I'm terrible at these earpiece microphones. I don't know. We'll see if this stays on. Can you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. Let me know if this stops working for whatever reason. I think it's not really on my ear right. Sorry about that. All right. So good afternoon, everyone. How many people were in my other session a couple of hours ago? Okay, great. Fair number of you. So I'll try not to repeat the same jokes, I promise. Anyway, my name is Brian Keller. My focus at Microsoft is on application lifecycle management, and that's primarily driven out of the Visual Studio team and Team Foundation Server, but increasingly, as those of you that attended my last session heard about, we are partnering across Microsoft to give a broader perspective on application lifecycle management overall, and that can include everything from our integration story with System Center to our integration story with Project Server and other products that may make sense when you start pulling in all those different roles. So that's primarily been my focus over the last few years. And this is actually my favorite session to deliver because this is a session where we dive deep into the software testing tools that we shipped in 2010 and updated again in 2012. So I'm curious, quick show of hands, is anybody using Microsoft Test Manager today? Fair number of you, great. And how many people are using Lab Management today? Okay, about what I expected. So lab management in 2010 was really kind of complicated to get all set up, and we've done a lot of work now to make it very easy for you to get started with lab management. So for those of you that have tried to go through that experience in the past, my sincere apologies. Hopefully after today's session, you'll see some of the investments we've made to make that a lot easier. And let's keep it interactive. If you have questions as we go, please, you know, raise your hand. It's kind of hard to see all the faces out there, so shout out if I'm not seeing you. As a reminder for folks that were in my last session, I put all of my virtual machines, my hands-on labs, my demo scripts, they're all online on my blog, so everything you see me do today, including the lab management demo, you can actually go download the virtual machine off my blog. You can go through and set up your own local lab managed environment based on this virtual machine. So you can get up and running with that, assuming you've got, you know, a machine that has enough RAM to run two virtual machines side by side. But there's also a couple of books that I've worked on as well, which talk about everything that we're going to be covering here today and more. So let's dive right into software testing, but before we do, I thought we'd look at some fun examples of why software testing is important. Obviously, you're all here, but it's always nice to kind of put things in perspective. This is the USS Yorktown. This is a ship that the U.S. Navy kind of reimagined, and they started to call it a smart ship. And so they started to add some electronic systems where previously a lot of the systems were mechanical and whatnot. And you know that when your project is called a smart ship, then something's got to go wrong, right? And so sure enough, something went very wrong with this ship. Unfortunately, the first time a crew member entered a zero in one of the data entry fields, it caused a divide by zero, and it actually shut down the entire ship for two and a half hours. So I really don't want to be the crewman that typed a zero into the text box and had to explain that's what caused the ship to go down. I especially don't want to be the software tester that was responsible for testing that scenario. We'll pick on Europe a little bit. This is the Ariane 5. They actually reused a lot of code that came from the Ariane 4. Unfortunately, it took a different flight path, and they forgot to test for that scenario. And as I'm sure a lot of you already know, the Ariane 5 actually blew up. It was about a $500 million mistake in the mid-90s, and no one was hurt, luckily. But unfortunately, this is another example of how costly software testing, or the lack thereof, can actually be. If you like these types of examples, by the way, there's a great presentation at OSCON a few years ago called An Illustrated History of Failure. And the presenter goes through and he attempts to quantify the value of a human life. And so he divides the number of working hours over a person's lifetime into the GDP for the country. And so on average, everyone in this room is worth about $2 million in terms of your total GDP. But due to the magic of software, for the first time in history, you can actually cause your own GDP and those of thousands of you, thousands of your peers, to actually disappear just by having one bad line of code. So that's the special place that software holds in our kind of, you know, modern civilization there. One more, if you've ever been to Sweden, there's this excellent exhibit called the Vasa Museum. This is a boat that was actually christened, I think, in the 1600s. And if you look up here, there's actually an extra row of cannons that was added kind of in the last minute. And what they forgot to do is they actually didn't go back and re-examine the original requirements for the boat to make sure that they added additional ballast down here to compensate for the additional cannons that they added up there. And so you can see the analogy to software, right? How often do we add features at the last minute and then don't go back and revisit the original spec? Now, the real kicker here is that this ship sailed. It sank about one nautical mile right outside of port because it basically just blew over. And unfortunately, something like 17 people died here. And QA had actually discovered the problem. They had sailors that ran back and forth from one side of the boat to the other and back and back. They did this three times, and then the person conducting the test actually told them to stop because they said that if you do this one more time, the whole boat is going to tip over on its side. And guess what? QA was ignored. So yes, this has been happening for a long, long time, folks. It's not just a modern problem. Of course, I work for Microsoft, so I would be amiss if I didn't actually mention some of our own examples of bugs that we've shipped in software. This is Visual C# 2005 Express. This is a team I used to work on. It's asking me to close system. I don't know how you would even go about doing that. Here's another one. This file is still copying. Something like 5 years it took this file to copy, right? An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. I don't know, perfectly okay error message, it's just missing a period at the very end. Otherwise, no problems there. And this one, how can you argue with that? You know, just, okay. So what do we do about this? So the whole software, you know, testing emphasis that we have in the product today around Microsoft Test Manager and Lab Management actually was first introduced in our Visual Studio 2010 product family. And in leading up to that release, we really took a look at the entire software testing industry and really holistically where quality needs to happen throughout the entire application lifecycle. And the first thing that we noticed is that as your cost of, or as you get further and further in the development of your software, the cost of failure goes up. And I like to think about my hobby back in Seattle, which is mountain climbing in relation to this. So when I'm, you know, in the winter months in Seattle, which seems like it's about 13 months out of the year, I spend a lot of time in the training gym, and I get to the point that the weather's nicer and I can start going outside and doing conditioning, and then I actually go climb some stuff. If I hurt my hand when I'm in the climbing gym, no big deal, right? I'm out of commission for a week, I go back in the next week and I'm okay. But if I'm out on the mountain and something goes wrong, the cost of failure is actually really, really high. This is my first glacier that I summited, and you can see just how sheer the drop-off is. Cost of failure is really, really high in that scenario. Same thing is true in software, right? If we can give developers the tools that they need in order to fix bugs within a few minutes of them happening, then they can have that contextual reminder that, hey, I just changed this line of code and this unit test stopped working, right? And so the same thing is true today, of course. We continue to give you, as a developer, software that you need in order to try to find those bugs as you're developing the code. But you can't oftentimes identify every single issue within your development environment. And that's why we have test teams. And so we really wanted to make sure that we extended what Visual Studio is offering over to test teams as well. And so the next question for us was, well, what does that mean? What does the software testing landscape look like? And so we looked at the spectrum of all the different types of testing activities that go on across these various segmentations. And so at the far left end of the spectrum, you have these generalist testers that do a lot of manual testing. They wake up in the morning, they have a list of test cases. There it goes. Where do I file a bug in the microphone? So they have a list of test cases that they run through day in, day out, and they try to basically simulate what the users will be doing with the software in order to generate some bugs. And then at the far right end of the spectrum, you have these programmers who are writing code that tests other code. Maybe it's unit tests, maybe it's web tests, maybe it's load tests, and so on. And the idea is that it takes all kinds, but really, if you look at most organizations, about 70% of the testing efforts are these manual testing efforts. And there's a good reason for that. Number one is, as your applications are evolving over time, the spec's changing, you're getting different design change requests from your users, it's hard to keep automated tests up to date. And so manual testers are very good at being able to adapt for the changing software and make sure their test plan is testing it correctly. The other thing is that, you know, unless you know that you're going to write a test to find a very specific issue, it can be very hard to compete with the brain of a human being sitting in front of a screen and trying to understand whether or not this software is working correctly. So we believe that this is here to stay, that there's always going to be a room for manual testers. The problem with that is that most of the testing tools out there really address the right end of the spectrum. How many unit testing frameworks do we need? I love unit testing just like everyone else, but do we really need a half dozen unit testing frameworks and web tests and that sort of thing? And so in the 2010 release, we really wanted to give manual testers a first-class set of tools to elevate them out of kind of the historical state of the art, which is having, you know, Excel and Word documents where you're tracking all of these test cases. The third thing we noticed is that when testers actually do find a bug, what happens? They go to a developer, the developer says, well, it works on my machine, right? Happens all the time. We've been on both sides of this. I'm sure everyone in this room has stories. And chances are that the tester really did find a bug, and chances are that it really does work on the developer's machine. But you then have to have a conversation to try to understand what was different about the test environment that caused this bug to happen that maybe isn't happening on the developer's machine. Or maybe the tester's interpretation of the test case is different than the developer's interpretation. But whatever the case may be, these disconnects end up costing teams a great deal of time. And unfortunately, a lot of bugs get resolved as no repro because the test team finds it and the development team can't reproduce that problem. And so we felt like we could solve these problems. Number one, we really wanted to make sure that we're addressing test teams as part of our integrated ALM story. Number two, part of addressing test teams means giving manual testers first-class tools that they can use to be productive, just like we're productive as developers within Visual Studio. And then finally, we want to solve this integration problem between dev and test so that you can more effectively communicate and build great software. So that's where Microsoft Test Manager comes in. That's where Lab Management comes in. I'm going to spend the rest of the time doing some demonstrations. And I showed this slide earlier. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. Just want to say that the real value of TFS starts to light up once you start bringing in all these different artifacts across your project. And that can include test cases. It can include requirements. It can include source control and builds and reporting and so on. And so in this presentation, I'm going to show you several ways in which these different artifacts link to one another and the different roles that use Team Foundation Server can collaborate by flowing their work through these various artifacts. Okay? So with that, let me drop into my virtual machine. Like I said, this is something that you can go out and download yourself. And it contains Visual Studio Ultimate, Team Foundation Server, and then a bunch of pre-canned project data, teams, so on and so forth, that you can use to really understand the way these scenarios work. And everything that I'm doing here is documented as hands-on labs if you want to go try it for yourself. So this is Microsoft Test Manager. It was built from the ground up specifically for generalist test organizations. And what you see here is a formal testing approach. That was our primary approach that we introduced in 2010. Later on, I'm going to show you a different approach that we really built on in 2012 called exploratory testing or agile testing. And I'll show you how both of those approaches work together. But to start with, the formal testing approach assumes that you're starting with a list of things that the team is building. So this is a list of requirements that I've pulled in from Team Foundation Server. It can really be whatever work item type you use to define the things that you build. Maybe it's user stories, product backlog items, and so on. And once you've pulled in that list of requirements, then you can start creating a list of test cases that are going to validate that those requirements are working correctly. So here you can see we have a requirement having to do with the shopping cart, and then we have a test case having to do with making sure that when the user goes in and types in, for example, -5 on the quantity field, that we don't end up paying them to shop from us. That would be a bad business model. So very simple test case. You can see this is just a work item within TFS. There's a couple of special things about this. First of all, actually I need to scroll down a little bit. You'll notice here this Twitter-style syntax. Basically, when I wrote that into the test step, then it generated this column for me down here, which allows me to data bind this test case to a list of test result or test parameters. And so every row of data that's in that parameter values column is going to prompt the tester to run this test case multiple times. That's not only useful in the manual testing scenario, but later on when we automate this, this same table can be used to drive the data behind your automated tests as well. And the nice thing about this model is that your manual testers, even if they're not familiar with how to write coded UI tests or how to crack open SQL and add a new row of data, they can come into the same test case that they've been using and they can add a new row of data. So later on, if you find out that using Canadian addresses breaks something in the way that your shopping cart scenario works, you can add that as a row of your test case instead of creating a brand new test case. So let me just show you quickly what it looks like to run through a test. As a tester, a day in the life, most of the time as a tester, you come in the morning, you click on the test tab. This is going to show you a list of things that you need to test for the day. This is the test case I was just looking at. Notice that it shows up twice here. The reason it shows up twice is that we've defined our test configuration matrix to instruct the tester that they need to run this test once on Windows 7 and then once on Windows Server 2008. And so you can actually define different test configuration matrices based on whatever values you want. Maybe it's based on OS, service pack level, language, different versions of specific libraries that you might expect in production. Anything you want, you can define those test configuration matrices. And you can also override those for a specific test case. So for example, if I knew that this particular test case was only testing back-end server-side logic, then I might come in and say, you know what, instead of asking the testers to run this on every configuration, we just want to have them run it on, you know, Windows 7 or whatever operating system is your default for testing. But we'll come back to the test tab, and we'll click on Run. And this is going to launch the Microsoft Test Runner. The Microsoft Test Runner is responsible for a few things. First of all, it's responsible for giving me the list of test steps. So when I'll go ahead and do it. I'll click on Start Test. On the left-hand side, this is just the list of test steps that the tester is going to run through. It's also responsible for capturing rich data in the background about my test environment. And I'll show you a comprehensive list of the types of things that we collect. But as one example, when I'm running through this test case, we can capture a video recording. That way, if we find a bug later on, we can attach that video recording to the bug, and the developer can see exactly what we're doing. Again, I'll show you where that's configurable. You can actually specify different values for different machines that make up your environment. So I'm going to also take advantage of another capability of Test Runner, which is the ability to fast forward through your test steps. And the idea is very simple, that this particular test case might be, in this case it's, you know, 8 steps long, but this might be a 20-step test case. And if you had a 20-step test case that consisted of creating a new user, signing in as that user, adding some items to your shopping cart, checking out, so on and so forth, maybe 18 of those 20 steps haven't changed in 3 weeks. But today, your job is to actually validate that the very last page of the checkout experience has sales text listed correctly. Well, we want to respect the tester's time and help them do their job more efficiently. And so when you record a test case, you have the option when you record it of actually capturing an action recording that allows you to fast forward that test case later on. And so what I can do is select the first few test steps in here. So I know that this part of the application shouldn't have changed since yesterday. I'll just click on play. It will go through and play back that automation sequence in the browser, and then turn the test runner back over to me as a tester for me to do my job, which is to validate that the application is working correctly. Okay? So at this point, test runner is saying quantity should have reverted to 1. It looks like it did. So I will say that this particular test step passed. And then just for fun, I'll go ahead and play the last 2 remaining test steps. And so at this point, that particular iteration of the test case was successful. I can end this iteration and go to the next one. And basically, it's going to feed that next row of data into this particular test run. So here down here, you can see we're using a quantity of 0. I think in the last iteration, we used a quantity of the letter A. So you get the idea. So we'll just cancel out of that for a moment, because I want to show you where you can define what data gets collected during these test runs. If I come back over to plan and click on properties, properties is where I get to define useful information about how the test runs should operate, how the test configuration should operate, and how we're going to select builds from Team Foundation Server. So test settings define what information we collect off of the various machines within our test environment. Now, in this particular environment, I just have a single virtual machine. But in a real-world environment, you might have multiple machines that play different roles within your test environment. And so you might have, you know, your local machine where you're running through your web browser experience. You might have a SQL Server database. You might have a web server. And you could define each set of test settings independently of one another on each one of those different roles. And so if we look at some of these test settings, the action log is the one that I showed you that is responsible for doing the playback, the fast forward of actions. Code coverage, this allows you to capture code coverage off of your ASP.NET applications so that later on you can look at a report that says whether or not your test plan was sufficiently exercising the various functionality throughout your ASP.NET web application. I should mention that I'm using Visual Studio 2012 Update 1. And that's what adds support for code coverage. We didn't have it available in RTM. So if you're not already using Update 1, make sure you apply that as an update. Some of these are configurable. So in event log, for example, maybe I want to capture all of the security events off of my SQL Server database. So I can come in here and define, you know, exactly what types of events I'm interested in. Test impact, I'll show you in just a moment. System information, I recommend always turning that on. That's going to give you some very basic information. Ah, he's bringing tape for me.
Here you go.
Thank you very much. Whoops. Actually, I need your help. One moment.
I got a new one.
Okay. So. System information, that's going to capture things like operating system level, how much RAM do you have on the system, that sort of thing. And then the video recorder is actually more than meets the eye, because you can actually come in here to video recording. And what I always like to point out is that you can actually capture a video recording even if the test case passes. And so this is really helpful for two scenarios. Number one, I see a lot of customers using this for ad hoc documentation. So maybe I'm the product manager. I want to see how a particular feature was working in last night's build. Well, my testers are already exercising those features. So I can now run a query that says, show me the test run from last night's build. And that way, I can quickly see how that particular feature is working in that build. The other reason that it's helpful to capture video recordings if a test case passes is if you're outsourcing your testing efforts. This way, you can go back and audit and make sure that the testers that you're hiring to test your application are actually exercising your test cases properly. So nice little way to do that. So I mentioned this test impact analysis. Let me, and of course, IntelliTrace. Hopefully, everybody is familiar with IntelliTrace. But if you're not, IntelliTrace basically allows you to go back in time and see the execution history for your .NET application. And that's really helpful if you have, you know, an exception that happened after 5 minutes of execution. You want to understand how that exception happened? Well, with IntelliTrace, you can pull that in from your test run. You can open that up within Visual Studio. And it's like having a debugger attached to the process, except you're going back in time from a process that the tester was capturing maybe, you know, 3 days earlier. And so from that IntelliTrace file, you can rewind and see all the interesting events. Every time I accessed the file system, every time an exception was thrown and caught, every time an ADO.NET call happened. So very, very helpful information. One thing to be aware of is that IntelliTrace does occupy a lot of space within TFS. So by default, we'll only include the IntelliTrace file if you file a bug from a test case. Otherwise, we'll take the IntelliTrace file and we'll discard it. For those of you that are TFS administrators, you'll want to make sure that you download the test attachments cleaner, which is part of the latest version of the TFS power tools. What that allows you to do is go back and clean up these old artifacts, whether it's video recordings, IntelliTrace files. And so, for example, you can say, get rid of all of the IntelliTrace files from, you know, the last sprint, because we're done with those. We need to reclaim some of that disk space. Okay. So I've shown you so far how Microsoft Test Runner can help you, or Microsoft Test Manager can help you organize your test plan. It can help you capture the results of your test runs. It can help you file bugs and capture really rich information so that as a developer, when we open that bug, it's not just a one-line description, but it's really a rich bug that contains, hopefully, everything we need in order to get in and fix the issue. There's another problem that we wanted to solve for the manual tester as well. And that is, how do we determine what to test? You know, so the first question is, when do I pick up a new build? In most dev teams these days, we have continuous integration servers set up so that we're building, you know, 20, 50, 100 times a day. Obviously, as a test team, we can't pick up every single, you know, build throughout the day. We may not even be able to pick up every build that comes out of the nightly build process. So one of the questions that testers try to answer is, when is it worth my time to install a new build? And so historically, that usually results in a conversation between the test lead and the dev team to try to figure out, okay, did you check in that user story? Is this bug fixed? Because we need to make sure that it doesn't repro anymore. And again, that's, you know, not always the best use of everyone's time. But what we can do is we can actually interrogate Team Foundation Server to get a lot of that information for the test team. And let me show you what that looks like. When I click on Assign Build, you'll notice up here at the top that it has the list of builds that are available and the current build that I'm using. So I'm using this build 318.3, and you'll see that the next build that came out is this 318.4. Down here is a list of all of the work items which were associated with changes that are checked into that particular build. And so when a developer checked his code into TFS, they associated it with a task, for example, and that shows up in the build report. So over here, you see that there's a particular task that was resolved. Someone wrote a regular expression, and they checked that code into TFS, and that's what showed up in the build. Well, that may or may not have any bearing on my particular test plan. I'm going to decide to go ahead and skip that build for now. But then if I look at the next build in the list, you'll notice that things get a little bit more interesting. So now you can see that there's a user story. Let me expand that column. You'll see that there's a user story that's checked in. And maybe I was waiting for this particular user story to be ready so that I could execute some new test cases out of my test plan. And so now all of a sudden, this build looks like it's a little bit more interesting. And if we look at the very latest build, you'll notice that we're continuing to add to this list. And so now I really can't refuse this build. This is just a great build for me to choose. Notice there's a bug fix in there. We need to make sure that bug no longer reproduces in the latest build. So I'm going to pick up this build. It's going to give me some new things to test. We have a new user story. We also have a bug that's supposedly fixed. But there's another question that testers struggle with as well, which is, over the last week, I maybe ran, you know, 1,000 test cases. 90% of those passed just fine. 10% of those I created bugs on. But now I'm picking up a new build. How do I know, you know, those 90% that were passing last week, how do I know which ones of those might be failing as a result of some regression? Well, if you're lucky, you can have a conversation with the dev team and try to understand which parts of the code base they changed in the latest builds and how that might affect some of the stories that you're trying to test. But chances are that's a really tricky conversation to have. And so one of the things that we enable for you is this feature called Test Impact Analysis. Test Impact Analysis works by analyzing your .NET code while you're testing your software. And so while you're running test case 41, we're looking at which .NET code gets invoked. So we opened up, you know, these three DLLs, and we access these five methods on this one particular DLL. Developer goes back, makes a change to that particular method. We can now trace that back and say test case 41, even though it was passing in the last build, there's some code that was executed by that test case that has changed. You might need to go retest that particular test case. Now, this is important. It doesn't mean that test case is going to fail. It also doesn't mean that the rest of your test cases that aren't impacted are safe, because there could be other external factors that we're not aware of outside of the .NET code base that are changing, external dependencies on database, that sort of thing. However, if you have 30 minutes before your lunch break as a tester, and you want to spend that time focused on test cases which have, we think, the highest probability to result in new bugs, then this is where you would start. So when I assign this build to my plan, it's telling me some of these test cases might need to be run again based on the impacted tests. This is a list of the test cases. Notice there's really one test case, number 40, that shows up across both of these configurations. So what I'll do is just go ahead and reset those to active. Now as a tester, when I come back and look at those test cases, it's showing those as active, which indicates to me I need to rerun those test cases. Okay? Any questions so far? Nope. Okay. Was there a question here? No? Okay. So we'll keep moving along. The next thing that I want to show you is, let's say that the test cases have gotten to the point that they're passing on a regular basis, the application is starting to stabilize. It's probably not worth your tester's time to have them run the same test case over and over again with the exact same results. What we would like to do is maybe turn some of these test cases into fully automated coded UI tests. So coded UI tests are a new test type we introduced in 2010, which basically simulates a user sitting in front of a mouse and keyboard and validating some parts of your application. And so if I drop back into Visual Studio now, while that's opening up, there's one thing that I like to use the test case work item fields for. I don't know why this guy isn't closing. So I was going to show you on the test case, because it's a work item within TFS, you can take advantage of workflow states, and you can use that in order to transition the various elements of your test plan. And so one field here that might signal to the development team that we're ready to turn this test case into an automated test is this automation status. And so as a manual tester or a test lead, once a test is passing on a consistent basis, you might then flip this over to a planned automation state. And that way, you can have a developer query for that and then take these test cases and turn them into coded UI tests. And so if I go back over to Visual Studio here, I'll connect to that team project. We'll just start a new test project. We can do this in C# or Visual Basic. I'm more of a C# guy. And we'll select coded UI test project. And there's two ways to create a coded UI test. One is you can just open up the coded UI test builder, start clicking through your application just like a user might, and we'll capture all the actions for you behind the scenes. The other way is to take advantage of that action recording that the manual tester created earlier when they were running through that test in the manual test plan. And so we'll take advantage of that action recording because the testers already did that for us. And this basically allows me to query for the work items. I could search for work items that have a planned automation state. I happen to know which work item I'm looking for here. And what that does is it takes that action recording and it turns it into C# code for me. So down here, you'll see a list of all the individual test steps. And so if you compare that list of test methods with what our original test case was, you'll notice that that's where we're getting the names of the methods. And one trick here is that when you're running through your test case, so if I go back and run this test case again, when you're recording the action recording, one thing to be careful of is that as you are performing each one of the actions, so as I open up, you know, this particular web application, I should then go ahead and pass that step. The next thing I'm going to do is click on Model Airplanes within my web app, and then I'll pass that step. And do this for every test step, and that way the actions that you perform within the application you're testing are then correlated with each individual step, and that's going to make it easier for you to maintain your test cases over time. If I just, you know, went through the test case and said that the whole thing passed, we would only get one step in here, and that would be, you know, a little bit difficult to maintain. But if I go to definition, you can see what's actually happening behind the scenes here, which is, quite simply, we're launching Internet Explorer to that particular URL. So at this point, if I ran this test case, it would actually run three times, once for each test parameter within that test parameter's grid within the test case. But there's one thing that we haven't replaced, and we haven't replaced the tester sitting in front of the machine visually inspecting the application and making sure that it looks correct. All we've done is we've captured the raw keyboard strokes and which actions I was able to click on as a manual tester. So what I need to do next is actually just insert some additional code using the coded UI test builder. And what I'll do is put the application into the state that it needs to be to validate. And I'll take this control down here, which is just a little crosshair. Whoops. Just a little crosshair control. And this is going to allow me to visually inspect the elements across any of the applications that we can detect. So that, of course, includes web applications. So you'll see here that it's selecting the DOM. And we can get some interesting results there. It also includes the browser itself. So we could validate any of these elements if we wanted to. If you're testing a WPF application, you would see that show up. And basically, when I select that particular quantity field, it's going to give me a property bag that shows me all the name value pairs that we can detect as properties on that particular control. One thing to point out is that some of your controls might be non-visual controls, like you could have a panel that you're trying to look for. In that case, you can use this D-pad here to help you navigate through the control hierarchy, go up, down, left, right, and try to find the exact control that you're looking for. At this point, I could add as many assertions as I wanted to for this particular control. So I could add an assertion that validates that the text is equal to 1. And for those of you that haven't upgraded to 2012 yet, you won't see this new box that we added. This new box is really helpful because it basically allows you to add some additional information about why this particular assertion failed. And that's especially helpful if you're adding, you know, a lot of different assertions throughout your coded UI test. And so you can give a signal to the tester who might be looking at a failed test and trying to figure out why did this test fail. And so this is a really basic example, but I might just say, you know, quantity should have reverted to 1, something like that, right? And so we'll generate the code for that. I could give a description and make it look nice, but we'll just say that's good enough for now. And now we've added that new method. And if we run that test, it should open up Internet Explorer and click through the application. So by default, we're using Internet Explorer for both the record and the playback experience. In November, we shipped Visual Studio 2012 Update 1. And one of the things that we shipped as part of that experience is an extensibility layer on top of Selenium for being able to play back your coded UI tests on other browsers. And my friend and colleague Marcel DeFries has a session, I believe it's tomorrow, where he'll go in deeper look at how you use that in order to record tests in IE and then play those back on a variety of browser experiences. So if that's something that you need to think about in your test organizations, I would definitely recommend taking a look at Marcel's session. So here you can see it clicked through my application, it validated my results, and everybody's happy. So that's good. So that's a quick walkthrough formal testing. So again, you start with the requirements, you build your test cases out from there, you run through your test cases on a regular basis based on the results of the build, and then occasionally you might upgrade a manual test into an automated test. Now, formal testing has its place, and I think it's something that's, you know, here to stay. Certainly, if you're delivering on a government contract or implementing an insurance application, you need to go through a formal testing approach to make sure that your software meets all of the requirements that you've signed up to deliver. However, there's another approach that's increasingly more and more popular, which is exploratory testing. Sometimes it's called XT testing or agile testing. And the idea with these approaches is that you don't restrict yourselves to just writing test cases and then trying to execute those test cases. The idea is that writing test cases can often oftentimes get in the way of actually just getting into the software and trying to break it and trying to find these different edge cases which result in some interesting bugs. The challenge with exploratory testing is that if everyone in this room sat down and did exploratory testing on a particular website, we're all going to kind of go off in different directions. And from a management perspective, there's a lot of criticisms of exploratory testing because it's hard to know exactly what you're getting for your money when you have testers spend time doing exploratory testing. Now, there's some approaches that have been out in the industry for how to address those types of problems. If you're interested in exploratory testing, there's an excellent book by a guy named James Whitaker. He actually was our original software architect for Microsoft Test Manager. He left Microsoft, went to Google, now he's back at Microsoft working on Bing. But he has some really good books that talk about approaches for exploratory testing. He has this concept of charters and tours. And the idea is that with a tour, you would get in and perform an exploratory testing session based on maybe a persona of a specific user. So if I think about my mom as a user on an online shopping experience site, she is terrified of giving her credit card number online. She's happy to browse online, but at the end of the day, she wants to pick up a phone and order her merchandise online. And so if I'm over the phone. And so if I'm performing an exploratory testing pass to validate that my mom is going to be comfortable, I might be looking out for a phone number on every page or a privacy policy on every page to help give her the assurance that she needs. If I'm pretending to be, you know, a teenage hacker, I might be trying to overflow every value on the page or doing SQL injects and that sort of thing. And so you can kind of bound your exploratory tests using these different tours. One of the challenges then becomes, how do you generate reasonable bugs based on those tours? And so you might be testing for 45 minutes before you find a particular bug. It can become difficult to communicate exactly what you were doing when you found that bug back to the developer. And that's a problem that we wanted to solve with Microsoft Test Manager 2012. So if instead of starting with a specific test case, I might come into the test tab and click this new button called Do Exploratory Testing, I can now bound my exploratory testing based on a specific work item down here. And so that work item could allow me to relate all of my exploratory tests back to a requirement, like Brian's mom should be able to shop from our website and feel reasonably confident in making her purchases. Or I could just do unbounded testing and just say explore. There's not really a major difference, except when you select a specific work item, that's then going to draw a relationship within TFS between any bugs you generate during that exploratory testing and the original requirement you selected. So at this point, when I click on Start, I don't have any test steps because it's now left up to me as a tester to do what I do best, which is to try to find bugs. And so at this point, I can just start opening up a browser, visiting the website, kind of clicking around. I'm going to look for anything that looks like a bug once the site finally loads. And, you know, I just might get in here and click around. And it's important to note that all of those test settings we defined earlier are still in effect. So if I said to capture an IntelliTrace file or a video recording or an event log, all of that information is getting captured behind the scenes for me. So I don't have to worry about trying to remember exactly what I clicked on. And so let's say that, you know, eventually I get tired of clicking on kind of the top level menus. I'm going to drill a little bit deeper and see what happens when I click on delete. And then, sure enough, I found a bug because we're actually missing some of the values down here. And so I might grab a screenshot, and that's going to be captured as part of my notes over here. And then I'll click on Create Bug. And when I do that, you'll notice that it's really helpful to have a list of everything that I was doing as part of that testing session. So now, as we're testing, we're actually capturing little thumbnails that show me exactly what I clicked on while I was running that test. The problem with that is that that can be really overwhelming for a developer. If you get, you know, a 45-minute testing session that turns into a bug that has 1,000 steps, that's way too much information. And so what I'll do instead is I'll help the developer a little bit by clicking to scope this down to what I happen to know is really relevant to that particular bug. So I selected the top-level dashboard on through the observations. We'll select that. And now what it's done is it's scoped that action log for me. And so now I can file a really specific bug. So delete page is missing some values. So I can save this and generate a bug, which is great. Developers are going to go fix that bug. But I think it's pretty important that the delete page actually has the values that we expect. And so after that bug is fixed, we want to make sure that we're testing that on a regular basis. And so this is where we start to blend both of those approaches. So I can take that bug and I can actually generate a test case as well based on everything that I was doing in there. And so when I create that bug, I'll also say create a test case as well, and it's going to start with those same actions in mind. So I can say make sure the delete page contains the right values. And then down here, you'll notice, for those of you using 2010, we now support rich text. That was like the top feature request. You wouldn't believe it. Please do not confirm delete. You can make that red. You can get really crazy now. And so when I save that, it's going to put me back into the Microsoft Test Runner. I can keep testing from my exploratory approach. And the idea is that I might be doing this all afternoon, filing one bug after another. And then once I'm finished, I can click on In Testing. It's going to save the result of my test run to TFS. And again, as a manager who's interested in the value, the ROI you get out of exploratory testing, these reports can be really handy because I can go back and I can say, well, we asked Brian to do 2 hours of exploratory testing on Friday, and this is a list of all the bugs and all the test cases that were generated as a result of that effort. So all that data gets saved within TFS, and you can see here's the list of bugs, and here's the list of test cases that I generated. So that's kind of a blend between exploratory testing and formal testing. We're actually making really good time, so if anybody has any questions before I move on to lab management. Yeah? Good question. So his question was, do we support automated testing for Silverlight? Yes, we do. The way that you enable that is you will have to go to the Visual Studio Gallery, and there is a project there that allows you to grab a set of DLLs that you can then include in your Silverlight project when you build it that spits out the appropriate accessibility hooks so that our test engine understands what you're working with as you're navigating the Silverlight application. And so that actually brings up a good topic, which is what does the test automation work well with? And so we work really well with, you know, traditional Windows forms, WPF applications, web applications, as you saw, Silverlight, if you get that add-in. If you're using third-party controls for rich client applications like WPF and Windows forms, you will need to contact your third-party control vendor to make sure they support the test automation extensibility that we support. So DevExpress, for example, they ship a set of DLLs that you can include in your project, just like you would with the Silverlight example, and make sure that that test automation works. So you'll have to contact your control vendor. If you're using third-party controls on web applications, then generally you don't need to go through that process because it's all just HTML and JavaScript, so we can inspect that at the DOM layer. But for rich client applications, you'll need to go grab that. Yeah?
And do the impacted tests feature also work with JavaScript code that has changed?
Yeah, good question. The question is, does the test impact analysis feature work with JavaScript code? The answer is no. It only works with .NET framework-based code. So anything .NET Framework 2 and above will be captured there. Yeah, in the back.
How much performance drain is there on enabling extended
iteration? Sorry, I can't see who asked that. Oh, hi. So that's a good question. The question was how much performance overhead is there with enabling IntelliTrace? So there's two performance hits that happen when you enable IntelliTrace. The first is that we have to rejit the application, and we have to insert a bunch of checkpoints along the way so that we can capture that rich eventing information. So that's one compile time hit that you'll take. One trick to kind of make sure that you minimize that is that if you select multiple test cases when you start your testing run, so if, for example, I come into the test tab, I run tests, I can actually select multiple test cases, and that will only rejet the affected applications once during that particular test run. Now, there is also an overhead associated with having IntelliTrace enabled post-JIT process, and that overhead is going to vary. It's going to vary based on whether or not you're collecting verbose or basic information. It's also going to vary based on the complexity of your application. I've seen anywhere from 5% performance hit to 80% performance hit. So it really depends a lot on what you're doing. SharePoint has a very deep call stack, especially SharePoint 2013. So when you start trying to do things like enable IntelliTrace with those types of applications, then performance can start to slow down. So it's not something that we recommend running with all the time. Usually what I do when I'm running my test runs is I will run without IntelliTrace enabled until I find a bug. And then what I'll do is I'll go back and try to repro that bug with IntelliTrace turned on. So that's why we allow you to have multiple test settings. And when you run your test cases, you can actually select run with options. And you can select a different test setting. So here I've defined one called lightweight diagnostics and another one called full diagnostics with IntelliTrace enabled. Good question. Yeah, in the back. I only caught part of that. You wanted to run tests in a batch overnight, and what was the other one? Web forms application, is that what you said? Yeah, so I'm going to show you lab management in the next part of my demonstration. I think that's probably going to hit on what you're asking for there, where you can really run a batch of automated tests over in a lab and get some results out of that. So yeah, good question. So that's a good question. So he's saying that he had always heard that you need to have a developer write a coded UI test. I mean, it's code after all. But here, what I showed is I really didn't have to write any code. I just used the design experience, if you will, to generate the code. I would say that for very simple tests, you don't really have to have a strong background in, you know, writing code. Of course, you can go through that experience that I just did. But for anything interesting, I would say you do need to be a developer and kind of understand what's going on behind the scenes and how to maintain those coded UI tests over time. So I see a lot of people that are manual testers see that as an approach to kind of aspire to become developers, and they use that to bridge their knowledge of testing and get into the development space by taking that first step into creating coded UI tests. So I think that works really, really well. But I don't try to sell this to people that have no interest in learning how to code. So I think that is a little bit overselling that feature. There are testing solutions that are purely script-based that don't require you to really know, you know, code per se. This isn't really one of those. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What about Windows Store apps?
Windows Store apps with respect to automation. Yeah, so our automation story does not work today with Windows Store apps or Windows Phone apps. I would say it's high on our backlog to provide that experience, but I don't have any timelines to share. However, you can use this manual testing experience with Windows Store applications. It actually works really well. I didn't bring my tablet with me, but if I did, what you can do is you can run Microsoft Test Manager on your desktop or your Surface Pro, and then you can have a tablet that you remote over to, and what you see on the left on your desktop is you see a list of the test steps, and as you're running through those test steps on your tablet, we can actually capture that you swipe to the right, swipe to the left, pinched and zoomed, and when you get that action report that I showed you with the images, you'll actually see that light up. I did a video on Channel 9 if you want to go see that experience. But it works really well because you can be testing with the expected consumer result, which is using a tablet machine, and you can still collect the full fidelity rich information that you would expect might be helpful once you actually start to file bugs. Okay. If I'm missing anyone, please shout out. I can't see all the hands in here, so. All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. And while we're doing that, I'm just going to reset the state of my virtual machine. And while that's happening, I'll introduce lab management. And apologies to the folks that were in my talk today. I'm going to repeat a little bit of this. But the idea with lab management really hits on what this gentleman was asking, which is, I want to build my code. I want to see what happens when I push that code out to an environment, which might simulate my production environment. And then what I want to happen next is to run my automated tests against that system overnight. And then I want to use that environment to run my manual tests in as well. And that entire process can be automated up until the point that we hand it over to the manual test teams to work with. And so in 2010, we introduced this capability called lab management. And it basically uses team build over here as a piece of team foundation server. We generate the compilation, whatever the result of your solution output is today. It's just the same there. From there, we then copy the build to the running environment. An environment can be a virtual environment, or it can now be a physical environment as well, and I'll talk about the differences momentarily. And so in this environment, we have two machines. One's a database server, one's a web server. If we're using a virtual environment with SCVMM, SCVMM can actually do a lot of the heavy lifting for us in terms of automatically rolling back the environment to some known snapshot, which maybe doesn't have our application on it yet, and then taking a snapshot of the environment when we find a bug. In that type of configuration, you'll have a physical VM host, which has a VMM agent that connects to System Center Virtual Machine Manager. But in any event, after you deploy your software to these machines, then we can run all of the automated tests as part of that process. We send those test results back to Team Foundation Server by way of the test controller. And so in 2012, one of the things that we did is we added this new environment called a standard environment. And so if you look at the difference here, the virtual environment that uses SCVMM actually requires that we have SCVMM running on a host machine, and then we have these VM hosts, which are the physical machines you're going to run your test lab infrastructure on, and then we deploy the virtual machines, and we can actually use a library and spin those up on demand. It's a very, very cool experience, and it makes it really easy for you to scale up and down your test loads as required. The challenge with that for some organizations is that setting up SCVMM and using Hyper-V as part of that process starts to become a non-starter. Number one, I hear a lot that organizations may be standardized on a virtualization stack other than Hyper-V, and so starting to use this experience can be challenging within an enterprise if that's your corporate standard. And then the other requirement, of course, is that you have somebody that's familiar enough with System Center Virtual Machine Manager to set up this process. And so we introduced this standard environment, and with a standard environment, you can still get most of the same functions here. So you can still set up a build, deploy, test automation system. You can use that for your automated and manual tests. And you can use that on any physical machine or third-party virtualization stack. So I can, a common scenario, I might have Windows 8 as my primary developer desktop, and I'm coding throughout the day, but I'm writing enterprise software, so I need to make sure that my software runs well on a Windows Server environment with SharePoint Server installed. And so maybe I have a VM that I have running either on my machine or on another box under my desk, and I want to periodically throughout the day take my code from TFS, push that out to that environment, run a bunch of unit tests, run a bunch of coded UI tests, maybe do some ad hoc manual testing throughout the course of the day. That's what standard environments make really, really easy to do now. And so I'll show you how you would go about setting something like this up. Basically, what I have here is I have two virtual machines. One is a lab management guest, and so this is just a machine that's running Windows Server on it. If I show that to you here, you'll see that we have this test agent that's running in the lower right-hand corner. The test agent is responsible for deploying the build. It's also responsible for running the tests and reporting the results of those tests, including all of those rich test settings, whether that's video recordings, event logs, and so on, back to Team Foundation Server. And so On this particular machine, I'm running the test agent as an interactive process, which means that when you configure it, it's going to do things like turning off the screensaver, logging in when the VM boots up, and that way it effectively assumes control of the mouse and keyboard so that it can run through those tests. If you aren't running coded UI tests, you don't need to configure it as an interactive process. You can actually have it sit on the login screen, but I think it's a lot more interesting to show you a coded UI test that's running here, so that's why I've set up this example. If we go back to my VM now, I'll show you the environment that I configured. I already did this in advance, but I'll just show you the overview of the experience and how you would set this up. When you create a new environment, whoops, need to get Zoomit running, sorry. So when you create a new environment, you basically specify the name of the machine or the IP address that you have administrative rights to. And what we'll do in 2012 is we'll actually connect to that machine as part of this process and install and configure the test agent. For those of you that have done this in 2010, this is where it gets really painful, I see some heads nodding. So trying to actually install what used to be a test agent, a build agent, and a lab management guest agent as well. And so that was a big challenge that we've really solved in this particular release. This is the page where you would configure the account that that interactive process is supposed to run as. And so this is what logs in, disables the screensaver, and sets everything up to actually run through your test case just like a user would. And then once you're done with that, we'll just verify that that environment is something we can connect to. And once you click on verify, we'll connect to that machine, we'll install the test agent, we'll reboot it if it needs to be. And then eventually, once you're done with that, then the test agent will come up in this ready state. And that means it's ready to participate in build, deploy, test workflows. The other thing that you need to do is make sure that you have, if you want to run automated tests as part of this process, you need to start with test cases like we did earlier on, and you need to associate some automation with those test cases. So here's a simple test case that I've built some associated automation for, and we basically linked this to a coded UI test. Now, the way that you link that is you actually have to start in Visual Studio and open up that test case, and then select a specific automated test. It could be a unit test, it could be a coded UI test. You need to select one of those tests that resides in source control and add that to the associated automation tab. You can't add that from within Microsoft Test Manager. You won't have that option. If I go back over to Visual Studio, what really ties this experience together is the build, deploy, test workflow. And that's enabled by team build. And what we do is we basically create a build definition. I'm just going to kick this off so that it finishes and we'll make it a little bit faster. You can create a team build definition like you normally would for building your solution or your project, but instead of using the default process template for creating your build, you're going to select this lab default template. And the lab default template has a wizard that makes it easy for you to configure exactly what you're building, what environment you're using, what tests to run. And so here, if you look at the first page of the wizard, it's asking me what's the name of the environment. So this is the environment I configured back over in Microsoft Test Manager. If I was using an SCVMM environment, we have the option of reverting back to a specific snapshot. So that's the clean or baseline snapshot that you might use. So in this case, using a standard environment, it's up to you to make sure you're maintaining that machine and you're taking care of any diffs that may need to happen between build to build or cleaning up old test data. This is quite simply, what do you want to build before you kick off that lab management deploy and test workflow? And so in this case, I've selected another build definition within Team Foundation Server. That's what I kicked off a moment ago. And so that's just going to build whatever the output of my project is. Maybe it's a set of SQL scripts. Maybe it's a web deployment script. And then on this page, this is where I'm actually going to execute those scripts to actually deploy to each one of those machines. It could be a simple batch file. It could be an SSDT workflow where you're analyzing the target database to make it match your project database. Whatever you do today to actually deploy your software, that's where you're getting into specifying line by line what you want to deploy. So this is going to execute serially. Again, I just have a single machine here, but if you had a web server and a database server, then you would just select each one of those machines in serial, and you would specify which arguments you need to run on each of those machines. The nice thing about this is that everything that happens as part of this deployment process is actually going to be kicked back over to your build script, build report, so that you can diagnose issues later on. And then finally, what do you want to test? And so here, this is pointing to the test plan that I showed you earlier, including that test case. And so we're going to look in that test plan for any test cases which have associated automation that we now need to run in that particular environment. And so here, I just kicked off the compilation build in advance, so we're not waiting on that. I'll go ahead and queue a build, except what I'm going to do is override part of that wizard. So when you queue a build manually, you have the option of passing in override values here. And so I'm just going to say, instead of queuing a new compilation build, we'll just use the latest successful build. And now we'll click on queue. And so now that's going to kick off this process. And if I can get my screens configured just right, then you should be able to see this happening in both environments. So here you can see that the state of my agent is currently online. Now it's deploying build. It's going a lot faster than it did yesterday. So it's deploying the build. So it's just executing the copy onto this machine and then running through that batch file or whatever I've told it to run through. Meanwhile, all those deployment steps are being scripted back here. So whatever is being output as a result of that process, I could go back later on and diagnose and understand that. And now it's going to look at the test plan, and it's going to run that test case on this particular machine, unless something failed. Yes, so now test progress 0 of 0 completed. And it's going to run my coded UI test, which can take a few seconds to actually push down and spin up the browser. Once this gets going, if you were running, 30 test cases, this would be a lot faster once the first one runs. There's just a lot of stuff that needs to happen the first time it's copying the payload down and actually kicking off the build execution process. It looks like it timed out. That's the problem of not having a powerful enough machine to run two VMs at the same time. But if we ran this again, like one thing I could do is I could come back and I can take this test, see that it failed. I can run it again. And this is really helpful if you need to diagnose a particular build issue. I can run this again manually if I want to. Or I can just run it as an automated test, and then it's going to go through the same process again, but not do the build deploy test. So I've already deployed out to this system. I just want to run through this test again and see what happens. And so again, what happened is it kind of timed out because it was the first time it was warming up the ASP.NET application. So it got a little impatient here, but this should work this time. So while we're waiting on that, does anyone have any questions about lab management? How you might set this up. Yeah.
I know you can do it also with a desktop application, but then you need a build as well. And so are you familiar with that? Or?
You need a build as well for a desktop app?
So you need a build to do this process, but if it's not an application you build yourself.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so you're saying you already have a prepackaged application that you want to deploy into an environment to do maybe some integration testing?
It's already there.
Yeah.
So you don't want to deploy anything.
Sure. Yeah, you can definitely skip parts of that process. So if I come back over to my, now you can see my coded UI test is spinning up. Apologies for the delay there.
Let's say if you just want to start on Notepad, for example.
Sure. Yeah, you could definitely do that. So I'll show you where you would configure that. I think I understand what you're asking for. So if you come into the build deploy test definition, I could say use a build from a specific share that I want to deploy, or you could just fill this out with an empty value. So you could point to an empty path, in which case what you're saying is you're not actually building anything. We're going to try to copy whatever is in that path to the build machine as part of the deployment process. But if you come in here and say you really don't want to deploy anything, then you can just say don't deploy the build, in which case you're just going to set up maybe an automated test run within an environment. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. You need, if you want to automate the process of kicking off the automated testing, so every night at 2 o'clock in the morning, we want to compile my project, deploy my project, and then run some tests, then you need to have a team build definition which defines that workflow. Now, you can skip any point of that process. So you can use an existing build that you've already compiled. You can choose not to deploy the build. You can choose not to run the test. So those are all options that you can just turn off as part of that build deploy test process. You need the workflow to do it. The other way that you could run those automated tests is just by kicking them off from Microsoft Test Manager, like I did over here. So I right-clicked the test, and I said run that associated automation in this environment. Or alternatively, you could also run those from the command line if you wanted to. So you've got a few options, assuming you've already got that environment set up and configured the way that you want it. So I get the sense I'm maybe not fully answering your question. So let's chat afterwards, and I'll see if I can help you out there. Oh, yeah, so that's a great question. So how complex can this get, in other words? And so you can add as many machines as you want to your test environment. So if I come into Lab Center and I open up this environment, if I want to add more machines, I can just keep adding machines that make up this particular test environment. You can also add as many deployment scripts as you need. So if you need to, push out SharePoint bits to a SharePoint farm that makes up multiple machines within that environment, you can script each one of those. If you need to, whatever you need to do, you can script that as part of the deployment page. And so I have, customers that are doing some very, very complex environments. In the last session, I mentioned how Xbox is using lab management. The Hadoop team uses lab management to actually push their bits up to Azure on the back end. So yes, there's all those things are possible. And that's really the beauty of lab management, is that once you get things configured the first time, you should be able to just press go, and each and every time it's going to automate this out to as many machines as you need it to. Yeah. You can also set up multiple environments. So let's say that you need to have three different identical environments because you have three different manual testers that are connecting to those environments. In that case, what you can do is you can set up different build definitions. So I can come back to my build definition here. And when I configure a specific build definition, I can say this build definition is for this specific environment. And if I need to replicate that by three, I can just create three different build definitions to do that. So yeah, lots of possibilities there. Yes? Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So is it possible to use lab management in the cloud? It's not quite where we would want it to be. It's you could imagine, in the future, maybe having a solution where you say, I need three Windows Server machines, and one of them is a database, one of them is a SQL, a web server. Go spin it up, shut it down when I'm done so I'm not getting charged for those hours, that sort of thing. That's something that we would love to build in the future. There's a lot of work that goes into that type of experience. right now, one of the things that a lot of my customers are doing is they're spinning up an Azure IaaS VM, and they're using it similar to how I'm using it today. So they're managing, you know, spinning up that VM, spinning down that VM, and basically treating it like a standard environment. You do need to make sure that you have, you know, the proper networking ports open up so that your Team Foundation server can connect to that environment and push the bits down. But that is possible. You can do that using on-premises Team Foundation server or a hosted Team Foundation service. So I would say, yes, some scenarios are possible in the cloud, but it's not everything, not like the full SCVMM environment and that sort of thing. You start to run into some issues there. Yes, standard environment is definitely possible. Just remember, you'll be responsible for managing the process of spinning those machines up and down. And just remember that with Azure IaaS, unless you delete that VM, then you're still getting charged for it. So some of my customers have started to write some scripts around trying to automate, you know, spinning up and spinning down those VMs and deleting them and parking them in blob storage when they're not using them. So that part is still a manual process today. Yeah. Trace back, I'm sorry? There's one word I'm not catching there.
When you have client service, and you want to see if your tests are hitting all the codes in the engine, or?
Oh, like code coverage. Yeah. So code coverage works for any .NET application if you're doing automated tests. It only works if you're doing manual tests for ASP.NET web applications. So depending on the type of tests that you're writing and the types of code coverage data you want to collect, you can enable that. And the way you enable that is you basically just come into the test settings for your manual test plan or for your automated test plan, and there's a box for code coverage that you can turn on. And then what that does is it then takes the aggregation of all of your individual tests against a particular build, and every time you run a test against that build, it adds that data to the code coverage results database within TFS. So you can go back and query a specific build and say, show me my code coverage for this particular build. And hopefully, you know, that's trending up as you get towards your release. So, I think, how much time do we have? -2 minutes. I'm very sorry for disrespecting your time. Like I said, there's a few folks that have some questions I wasn't able to fully answer. So please come up to me afterwards. I'll stick around. Thanks for spending the last hour and 15 minutes with me. I hope it was useful, and I hope to see you again next year. Thank you.